From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine crisis, including a look at religious orthodoxy in the region, what's happening in the search for a missing Malaysian passenger jet, plus Israel displaying weapons that says were destined for Gaza. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk is preparing a diplomatic push on his nation's political crisis. He's due here in Washington for talks tomorrow, Wednesday, with President Obama. Two leaders are to discuss the standoff over Crimea. Meantime, the Crimean government on Monday officially invited the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe to monitor a March 16th referendum that will ask voters if they would like Crimea to become part of Russia. Well, the fight over Crimea's future has pitted Russia against Ukraine, but is the multi-ethnic peninsula's loyalties, well, they're not so clear-cut. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more now from Yalta.
Yalta, a seaside resort on the Crimean coast, playground of Russia's czars, and near the end of World War II, where Allied leaders began redrawing the map of Europe. The map may be about to change again. Across Crimea, pro-Russian forces have taken control. And on Sunday, a referendum could help move the Ukrainian region to full Russian rule. Yet, for a region on the brink, tensions, for the most part, slid away for a day along Yalta's promenade. Families strolled along the shore, enjoying the sea and each other. Further down, a pro-Russian rally gathered under the watchful eye of Lenin, reflecting the sentiment of many in Crimea's ethnic Russian majority. Many, but not all. Svetlana is a Russian citizen. Her husband, Rustam, is Ukrainian, a Crimean Tatar. She moved to Ukraine 3 years ago and says Moscow's intervention in the name of protecting Russians is false.
Nobody does any harm to Russian people here. I know it myself. Everything used to be very peaceful until Putin came.
Rustam says the only harm is to the region's non-Russians. His comments attract some angry onlookers.
The rights of Crimean Tatars and the rights of Ukrainian people are being violated. I'm appealing to you. Please protect us. Have a look. This is exactly what I'm talking about.
But he says he's ready to fight for what is dear to him.
We are waiting to see what happens. If it changes, we will protect our motherland.
It's that concept of motherland that's at the heart of this conflict. For centuries, Russians claimed Crimea as their own. It has inspired generations of poets and playwrights, Chekhov among them, and Moscow is poised to claim it again. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Yalta.
As Ukrainians both inside Crimea and the rest of the country struggle with events of recent times, such as the former president Viktor Yanukovych fleeing the country, new interim leaders being chosen from the opposition, planning for a nationwide election, and that referendum vote set for next Sunday in Crimea, there is another aspect of Ukrainian life which has an impact on what's happening. Many Ukrainians are members of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is part of the Russian Orthodox Church. An Orthodox priest has been seen among the protesters and the Russian troops in Crimea. For some understanding of Orthodoxy and how it is associated with the governments of the nations in which it exists, VOA's Doug Bernard spoke with Marian Simeon, assistant director of the Boston Theological Institute and an Orthodoxy scholar. He said Orthodoxy almost always exists in a dependent relationship with a host government.
Faith leaders are political leaders in many ways, and they make decisions based on the rational choice model to increase their popularity or their power or their authority or to maintain it.
Is this in some ways why we're seeing images, for example, Russian troops or Russian leaning paramilitaries serving stationed in Crimea, and yet very close by are Russian Orthodox priests offering blessings and, you know, singing psalms, that sort of thing?
Yes, because the church, unfortunately, in Russia and not only, has become the resonance box of the state. And whatever the state wishes, the church cannot completely contradict it. We've seen a similar situation during the war between Georgia and Russia, when initially the leaders of the church, both in Georgia and Russia, which are both Orthodox countries predominantly, they were trying to mediate the conflict only to go back to nationalistic stereotypes within a matter of 2 or 3 days. And we see the same thing happening in Ukraine versus Russia. Also, something else that is happening, there are groups of Bulgarians and Serbs forming to go with the purpose of going to Crimea to defend their nation, which is under attack. So it gets very complex, but just for the listeners to understand, it is a loyalty test that faith communities have to take. So the loyalty, unfortunately, seems to be primarily to the nation rather than to the church.
In some forms of various religions, some forms of Christianity, some forms of Islam and elsewhere, there's a sense that no matter where you are part of the brotherhood, to use that term, of X faith. Is that true in Orthodoxy? Because what you're describing sounds more like a compartmentalized sense of identity.
Absolutely. Orthodox Christianity teaches that is a universalistic faith that goes beyond localities and ethnicities. So that is in theory. In practice, when we deal with situations of violence, it becomes very parochial. It makes decisions that are momentum-driven and which obviously contradict the teachings. We have many, many cases of heresies. We have cases in which religious symbols have been used by the state with the complicity of the church itself to justify certain actions.
Marian Simeon is assistant director of the Boston Theological Institute and an Orthodoxy scholar. He was speaking with my colleague, Doug Bernard. VOA is following events in Ukraine closely and reporting on them at our website, voanews.com. Check it out.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
The mystery of the disappearance of a Malaysian passenger jet deepened on Monday, with investigators concluding that oil slicks found off the coast of Vietnam are not connected to the aircraft. Officials in Kuala Lumpur say a laboratory analysis showed that the streaks of oil found in the Gulf of Thailand were of the type used by ships. Malaysian officials say there is still no sign of the missing passenger plane nearly 3 days after it disappeared with 239 people on board. One investigator said searchers have found nothing that appears to be from the Boeing 777, despite some reports of debris floating in waters south of Vietnam.
We have not found anything that appears to be objects from the aircraft, let alone the aircraft.
The plane disappeared from radar on Saturday morning, about an hour after it took off from Kuala Lumpur. It was on its way to Beijing. Officials say there was no closer to finding what might have happened to that aircraft, and they've not ruled out anything, they say, including hijacking or a mid-air disaster of some sort. About two-thirds of the people on board were Chinese nationals, with the remainder from Asian countries, Europe, and North America. Investigators from 8 countries, including the U.S., have been searching for the missing plane and investigating 2 passengers who boarded the aircraft with stolen Italian and Austrian passports. Now, reaction and some analysis regarding that missing jet. James Chen, Malaysia expert at Monash University in Kuala Lumpur, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Malaysian people are watching the search effort very closely as authorities try to unravel the mystery of that aircraft's disappearance.
What was interesting about this case was that there was no warning at all. Apparently, when the plane went down, there were no reports of anything happening with the plane. The last contact they had with the plane was 1:30 in the morning, and the earliest the alarm was raised was at 2:30 in the morning, which means there was 1 hour gap in the reporting system. The other interesting thing about this case is that no debris has been found, so many people are speculating that it probably wasn't a mechanical failure. It could be something else.
Can you tell me about Malaysian Airlines and their track record?
Malaysian Airlines is one of the safest airlines in the world in terms of its safety record. So many people were very surprised by this incident. Moreover, people were also very surprised because the Boeing 777 has one of the best safety records in history.
There is some indication that the plane may have tried to turn around during its flight. Can you confirm that?
No. The story about the plane turning around was based on data logs kept by the Malaysian Ministry of Defense. There are no independent verification that the plane was trying to turn back.
So apparently it'll take some time for any kind of evidence, including the much-looked-after flight recorder and cockpit voice recorder, recovered.
Exactly. One expert actually mentioned that if the plane went into the sea, there may not be any debris left and that it may take up to a year to look for the plane.
What can you tell me about what Interpol is reporting that two passengers managed to get on board using stolen passports?
Yes, according to Interpol, two fake passports were used and both of them were bought from the same travel agency in Pattaya in Thailand. The latest report suggests that in addition to the two fake passports, there are two additional passengers with dubious passports as well. So a total of four passengers now are now under investigation.
Robert Blum, an American investment banker in Beijing and managing director of the Keen Resources Asia Limited, tells Victor Beatty there is also intense interest in the story on the streets of Beijing.
People on the street are talking about this. I went in just to charge my cell phone yesterday, you know, and the guys are hanging around the shop there. They're all talking about this.
Robert, is there any speculation about what the cause may have been?
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation. We all know that. There's, number one, because of those passports, that it could be terrorists. It's only 12 countries use the Interpol database, you know, to check the passports. So Malaysia didn't do that. It's very rare for two people to be on the same flight that would have that kind of, you know, those false passports. So there's a lot of speculation like that. On the other hand, they haven't found any debris. This story is going to be around a long time in the Chinese media as well as everywhere else as people, you know, slowly figure out what's going on. The Malaysians have been too tight. Look, the Chinese complaint, number one, is the Malaysians were slack and attending to their needs. You know, didn't send any representative out there. Of course not. They don't have any personnel at the airport. They got one flight a day or whatever. They have one person comes out there. Maybe they hire somebody from another airline to serve them. They were totally unprepared for this. It's not, you know, it's not that they have a high accident record. Their average for that type of middle-range country, 120,000 flights a year. You know, they have, one accident. So it's standard rate for that type of country. But they didn't have people on the scene. You know, there weren't, you know, they didn't have the psychologists. They didn't have people coming. The Chinese are complaining a lot about that. They're not getting attention. They didn't get attention. They're not getting news fast enough. Even the Malaysians are tight about security. They say, oh, this is a security issue. They're not forthcoming fast enough. You know, they've seen those videos now. They got videos of these guys and so on, but they're still organizing their story, you know. This is bad PR. You know, you got to be up front fast with the news. People want to see that. The Malaysians don't understand this yet. They're learning, you know. So a lot of the Chinese complaint is just the amount of service they're getting out of Malaysia in answering their questions and being up to date with news as it happens.
Scott Hamilton, a Seattle-based aviation industry consultant with Liam Company, tells Victor Beatty it's difficult to know what make this happen in this particular incident since there's no known debris field.
There was no communication from the pilots prior to the disappearance. That suggests that either something very catastrophic happened or probably some criminal act happened that precluded them from communicating, but it's very strange that there's been no debris field up to this point.
Can you think of any similar type of air accidents that have happened like this at such high altitude?
Of course, the Air India incident was a bombing, destroyed the airplane. There was a debris field that was on the surface of the ocean as a result of that bombing, so they were able to identify more or less where the bulk of the wreckage came down. You had TWA Flight 800 out of New York. That was climbing through, I think, about 11,000 feet after takeoff from JFK. That blew up from the vapors in the empty center wing fuel tank igniting. There was, of course, a lot of debris in the water on that. You had Air France 447 from Rio de Janeiro to Paris back in 2009. That airplane lost the ability to fly. It stalled at cruising altitude and pancaked into the water intact. And, of course, there was a lot of debris from that. So there have been a number of accidents that have happened from a elevation or a cruising altitude, and there was a lot of debris left. This is just a very strange one. You know, there's been no indication of the emergency locator transmission beacon that would go off upon impact with the ground or the water. It may well be that the airplane deviated from its intended flight path and everybody's been searching in the wrong location. They've widened the search area. It remains to be seen what, if anything, they find. It's my understanding that the depth where the search has been concentrated so far is, quote, only 600 feet. Air France went down in 4,700 meters. That's about 15,000 feet of water. It took them 2 years, but they did find the black boxes there. If indeed this went down in the Gulf of Thailand, I would expect that it wouldn't be too difficult to recover the black boxes once they locate the wreckage. The real question is, when are they going to locate the wreckage?
Aside from the black boxes, so what evidence might lead someone to understand what happened?
Clearly, they're going to look at all the radar images from the military and civilian radar stations in the various countries that are in the region. They're going to check the backgrounds of all of the passengers, not just these two, what I call passport passengers. They're going to check the backgrounds of the flight crew and the pilots. That's routine. They'll check the cargo manifest, the baggage manifest, to see if anything stands out from that. That's routine. You know, they're going to consider whether or not this was a bombing. They're going to consider whether or not this was a hijacking. They're going to consider whether or not this was a structural failure. They're going to consider whether or not there was some sort of clear air turbulence upset. They're going to consider whether or not the pilot went rogue and caused this event.
If something is found, do you anticipate an international tug of war over who will take the lead in this and who will be able to determine what was the cause?
The lead investigative agency would be the country in which the wreckage was found. So, for example, if this was found in Vietnam territorial waters or if the wreckage was found in the mountains of Vietnam, Vietnam would be the lead investigative country, and everybody else would be supporting that. Now, if the wreckage is found in international waters, I think that the country that the airline belonged to, in this case Malaysia, would wind up being the lead investigative agency, just as France was the lead investigative agency in the Air France 447 that crashed in the middle of nowhere in the Atlantic.
The disappearance of the Malaysia Airlines flight is a setback to that carrier, which has lost revenue to low-cost rivals such as Air Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Israel has put on display weapons from an intercepted ship it says were being sent from Iran to militants in the Gaza Strip. Iran has denied that charge, as we hear now from VOA's Scott Bob in Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu displayed the arms at a news conference in the Red Sea port of Eilat. Flanked by senior defense officials, Mr. Netanyahu accused the world of standing by while the Iranian government arms Gaza militants who threaten millions of Israelis.
There are those who would prefer that we not hold this news conference here today. They feel uncomfortable that we show what is really happening inside Iran. They prefer that we continue to nurture the illusion that Iran has changed direction. They are not prepared to recognize that Iran, a brutal regime, has not abandoned its deep involvement in terrorism, its systematic efforts to undermine peace and security throughout the Middle East, and its ambition to destroy the state of Israel.
But he says the facts we are showing on this platform prove the exact opposite. Israel announced the weapons discovery last week after boarding a Panamanian-flagged ship in the Red Sea. The government distributed videos of its soldiers unloading the weapons from containers from the ship. It said the arms were hidden under sacks of cement that originated in Iran. The Israeli government said it seized 40 rockets, 181 large mortar shells, and 400,000 rounds of Kalashnikov bullets. It said the rockets have a range of 160 kilometers, which mean they could reach most urban centers in Israel. Israel said the arms were made in Syria and flown to Iran, where they were loaded onto the ship headed for Port Sudan. They were then to be transported overland via Egypt and smuggled into Gaza. The governments of Iran and Sudan have denied the charge. An official of the Hamas group that controls Gaza, Taher al-Nono, called it a big lie. He says this is a silly claim and futile fabrication aimed at justifying the blockade of the Gaza Strip. In reality, he says, Gaza is blockaded, and they are talking about a ship that was found in the Red Sea thousands of kilometers away. Israel has maintained a naval and land blockade against Gaza since Hamas seized power 7 years ago. Gaza residents have used smuggling tunnels from Egypt's Sinai Desert to bring in food, construction supplies, as well as arms. Egypt's military-backed government has destroyed many tunnels since it seized power 8 months ago, but some reportedly continue to operate. Iran and six world powers have negotiated a temporary agreement aimed at ending Iran's alleged nuclear weapons program in exchange for an easing of sanctions against it. Israel has sharply criticized the negotiations, saying Iran has no intention of abandoning its program. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
In light of the deadly weekend suicide car bombing at a security checkpoint in southern Iraq and ongoing tensions in the region, U.S. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Saki responded Monday to reporter questions.
Iraq has made significant progress in improving relations with some countries in the region, such as Kuwait and Jordan, but progress with others has been limited. We continue to encourage improved ties between Iraq and its Arab neighbors, particularly the GCC. The situation in Syria has certainly fueled tensions in the region, and foreign fighters are making their way into Iraq from Syria. We are particularly concerned, of course, about this. We share Iraq's concern over the levels of violence, and we are working with the Iraqis to implement a holistic strategy.
Iraq has seen a spike in violence since last April, with the death toll climbing to its highest level since the worst of the country's sectarian bloodletting in 2006 to 2008. UN estimating 8,868 people were killed in 2013, more than 1,400 people killed in January and February this year alone. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the weekend attack, but it bore the hallmarks of an al-Qaeda breakaway group that frequently uses car bombs and suicide attacks to target public areas and government buildings. Iraq is to hold its first parliamentary election since the U.S. troops withdrew in late 2011. NSA leaker Edward Snowden, speaking via live video conference Monday, told a packed audience at the South by Southwest festival in Austin, Texas, that he acted because he believed the U.S. Constitution had been violated. Former U.S. National Security Agency contractor who remains in Moscow living in temporary asylum faces felony charges here in the U.S. after revealing the agency's mass surveillance program by leaking thousands of classified documents to media outlets. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is coming your way very soon. Stay with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers, Marty Curcius and Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On March 11, 1669, one of the world's most active volcanoes erupted. Lava from Mount Etna on Sicily's east coast destroyed several communities, leaving thousands dead. In 1708, Britain's Queen Anne rejected the Scottish Militia Bill, a measure that would have armed the Scottish militia, but which stirred fears of Scottish disloyalty. That was the last time a British monarch vetoed legislation. On this date in 1779, the U.S. Congress established a Corps of Engineers for the United States. 23 years later, the Army Corps of Engineers was created. The Corps has provided combat engineering support in every U.S. military conflict since. In 1864, the newly constructed Dale Dyke Dam burst, pouring hundreds of millions of liters of water down on the unsuspecting population of Sheffield, England, and surrounding towns. Some 270 people were killed in what is today called the Great Sheffield Flood. In 1941, Congress approved the Lend-Lease Act, a program under which the then-neutral United States provided Britain, the Soviet Union, and other allied nations with billions of dollars worth of food and war materiel. In 1978, Lebanon-based Palestinian militants hijacked an Israeli bus near Tel Aviv, eventually blowing it up in a shootout with Israeli soldiers. At least 35 civilians were killed. Israel retaliated with a military incursion into Lebanon. On this day in 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev became the last Soviet Communist Party General Secretary, embarking on reforms that would lead to the dissolution of the country 6 years later. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Some of the world's busiest shipping lanes trace along the northwestern Arabian Sea, where it laps the Horn of Africa and narrows toward the Gulf of Aden. Since the second phase of the Somali Civil War began around 2005, this area has been teeming with pirates. In 2008 alone, pirates launched 111 attacks on ships, 42 of which succeeded. The ships and their crews were hijacked and held for ransom. The pirates upped the ante in 2009. The rate of attacks increased tenfold in January and February of that year, as compared to the same period in 2008. Seeking to stop the hijackings, the international community established in January 2009 the Contact Group on Piracy off of the coast of Somalia. This diverse group brought together numerous countries, international and non-governmental organizations, to coordinate their efforts to counter piracy off the Horn of Africa. Since then, the Contact Group has grown to an open and vital architecture of 80 nations and organizations, including the entire spectrum of stakeholders, different ministries, international and non-governmental organizations, many sectors of the maritime industry, and representatives of civil society, said Donna Hopkins, U.S. State Department Coordinator for Counterpiracy and Maritime Security. The figures speak for themselves. There has been no piracy hijacking off the coast of Somalia since May 10, 2012, over 20 months. This is the lowest rate of attempted hijackings in over 6 years, and certainly since the peak of the crisis in 2011. This remarkable turn of events is due not only to the multinational counter-piracy operations preventing and disrupting pirate attacks, but also because commercial ships are helping by protecting themselves, including the use of armed security teams. Nonetheless, though the situation has improved, passage through the area is still dangerous. The group continues to prevent pirate attacks at sea, but it also works to undermine support for the pirates on shore and works with the Somali government to offer alternative employment to would-be pirates. This is an international law enforcement effort to bring to justice the handful of kingpins who operate this terrible enterprise, said Donna Hopkins. The fundamental conditions along the Somali coast have not yet changed, and if we drop our guard, piracy will return.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.